Trump was always a builder. Before he decided to remake Washington as a city fit for him to rule, with ballrooms and triumphal arches, he was putting up towers in New York, and high up on each one was his name, with nothing above Trump but the sky. Paul Goldberger has been keeping an eye on Trump the Builder for the last 40 years or so. Paul was the longtime architecture critic for the New York Times, and he then wrote on architecture for the New Yorker. He's also the author of the book, the pretty big title, Why Architecture Matters. Paul, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, good the ballroom, how's the design going? Is it getting any better?
Not so far as I've heard, no. It's enormous. It's, I think, more like a convention center or the kind of huge hotel room that you might find in a major city for big meetings than anything that belongs in the White House.
The White House is very carefully not a palace, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, when it was designed at the very end of the 18th century, rather, it was intended to make a very clear statement that this is a democracy, not a monarchy, and that, in fact, it was called the, you know, executive residence originally. It was where the man who ran the country would live, but it was also very deliberately secondary to the Capitol.
Do we know how it was decorated before the interior was completely gutted and rebuilt? Did it have all this gold that Trump is applying?
No. The gold that Trump is implying is all new. Nobody even tries to suggest it has a historical precedent. He's just saying he likes it better this way, and he's treating it as if he owned it, as opposed to being a temporary tenant in a house owned by someone else, which is to say the people.
But it'll be so easy to strip that shit out.
Oh, yeah, that's the least of it. The gold that he's put around his office and elsewhere in the White House is easily fixable. The ballroom will be a bigger problem if he builds his triumphal arch. That, too, will be a bigger problem. There are far, far graver issues in terms of what he's doing to Washington than the gold in his office, yes.
Paul, we have a tradition on this show, whenever we hear a dog, to ask for the dog's name and breed.
Ah, I'm happy to share that with you. And
yes.
I'm sorry that the dog has intruded.
No. A human touch.
Her name is Lucy, and she is a 17 and a half year old miniature poodle.
Whoa.
So she's getting on in years, and I'm surprised she had the energy to bark right now because she's usually pretty quiet.
Paul, I'm fascinated by the fact that the people who built the White House and Donald Trump are both going to the same kind of architectural vocabulary, classical architecture. What is the attraction for rulers of the style of Rome?
Well, you know, classicism is a big and wide canvas, we might say, on which you can paint a lot of different things. It is the style of Rome, of Greece before it was the style of Rome. It's been the style of so many other things. It's been varied continually, but it's kind of the core vocabulary of Western architecture, really. And you can do all kinds of things with it, and you can read all kinds of meanings into it. You know, in the early years of the U.S., when James Hoban designed the White House, who was an Irish architect, when Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Latrobe were working on the early plans for Washington and early buildings, it was really seen more in connection with both Greece and the Renaissance as a connection to ideals and as a symbol of democracy. We know at other times in our history, such as Albert Speer and Hitler, classical architecture has been a symbol of tyranny. It's been the very opposite thing. In each case, though, I think, even if they're after a very different kind of goal, people tend to feel comfortable with classicism because it reaches all the way back to ancient times, suggests a kind of continuity and almost a validation from that connection of whatever it is they're trying to prove with it. I mean, that's the amazing thing, that, you know, Albert Speer could use classicism to back up Hitler. In the earlier years of the U.S., we used classical architecture to back up democracy and show its validity. So it's a kind of blank slate on which we can write almost anything we want. But of course, there's so many different ways to do it, too. Yeah. I mean, it could be ornate and overdone and overdecorated. It can also be elegant and be sometimes almost as simple and abstract as modern architecture. It all depends on who's doing it, what they're doing, what they're trying to say.
But there are rules, aren't there? And if you put,
yes, there
if
are
you
indeed
put,
rules.
If you put a row of columns and then a pediment on top, that's a portico and that is an entrance, which seems indeed to have been overlooked by the designers of the ballroom.
Oh, you've noticed. Yes, good. That you're quite right. That the ballroom has a huge colonnade with a classical pediment on top facing the White House lawn. But in fact, you don't enter it there at all. It's all kind of fake.
While up the road, we have a triumphal arch. Now, that design is evolving as well, isn't it? How are we going there?
The problem there is not just the specifics of that design, but the idea of building anything there at all. You know, it's on a round grassy island on the Virginia side of the bridge that connects the state of Virginia to the center of Washington and goes right into the Lincoln Memorial. On the Virginia side is Arlington National Cemetery, which was created after the Civil War to bury the Union war dead. And the connection between that and the Lincoln Memorial was very, very conscious and intentional. And it's why that area has remained open ever since, so that you would feel a sense of connection between Abraham Lincoln saving the Union and where the people who gave their lives for that were buried. Nobody has ever built on that before. Trump wants to put his arch, which is commemorating, as he said, himself, not any particular war victory, in the middle of that, blocking that view. It kind of reminds me of how you may have noticed in a couple of different world events, either gatherings of heads of state at the G7 or other large conferences like that, or the recent thing the other day with the pictures taken of the Spanish team after they won the World Cup, Trump's tendency to kind of push himself into the foreground in someone else's photo. Well, it's kind of what he's doing with the arch on the city of Washington. You know, that was left open so that you would feel a connection between Lincoln and the war dead buried on the other side of the river, and Trump wants to just push his way into the middle and occupy and block that.
But, Paul, isn't there supposed to be a commission of some kind which is designed to save Washington
there
from whims
isn't.
Of this kind?
David, you're so right, and until now, it has worked quite well and actually been very, very engaged in a very positive way with so many different things that have happened in Washington. What's happened more recently is that Trump first tried to bypass the entire process of review, was told that that was not possible. So what he did was fire all of the members of these various review committees and commissions and so forth, and replace them with unqualified people who he knew were loyal to him. In one case, it was one of his like executive assistants or something who had no training whatsoever in architecture.
Yeah.
So what we're really seeing here is not just a failure of the architectural system, we're seeing a failure of democracy because the government is not working as it should.
But Paul, I think you're overlooking the possibility that that arch, once built, with its golden angels on top, mm-hmm. will be a warning for all time against what went wrong under Trump.
Well, David, I think that's a very wonderful and encouraging and optimistic view. I would say that my first hope is that it never get built at all.
Yes.
My second hope is exactly what you've just said, which is that if it's built, then it serves as a warning of the dangers and risks. There's a third possibility, of course, if it's built, which is that people just kind of get used to it, forget the origins of it, and in 50 years, people just think, oh, it's that, you know, arch, whatever. It's just like any other memorial. And they, you know, we have a huge capacity to become accustomed to things and tolerate them, particularly in architecture. That's probably good because, you know, we have to see architecture every day. It's not like a piece of music that if you don't like it, you don't play it, or a movie, if you don't want to see it, you don't see it. Architecture, you kind of have to see because it's there. So I think somehow mentally we learn to tolerate it because it would drive us crazy if we hated it every second of every day. So that may well be that it will be built, and in time, people will just shrug their shoulders and go about their business.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Paul Goldberger, former architecture critic of the New York Times, about the taste of Donald Trump. Now, Paul, perhaps it was as a developer that Trump developed his kind of fundamental way of working, which was always to find a loophole, always to find a way around the rules.
That's a perfect summary of his career. He has specialized in finding zoning loopholes, planning loopholes, labor law loopholes, financing loopholes, all sorts of things. He's been a bull in a china shop his entire career. And I think New Yorkers who had seen him from the very beginning of his career, you know, 45 plus years ago, are not as surprised, perhaps, as people elsewhere in the U.S. have been with the way this has played out.
What sort of things was he building when he was the builder in New York?
When he was the builder, well, a mix of things. He first became a major figure in New York building a hotel next to Grand Central Terminal, the train station, at a time when things were grim in New York, not much was happening. The economy was very bad in the late 70s. And I think there was so much excitement about somebody building anything that the city was very willing to grant him a lot of concessions in terms of, you know, city support, in terms of bending certain regulations, things like that. And then, of course, it was his way to think of that as the new floor rather than an exception for difficult times. So he would demand more and more each time. And then he followed with Trump Tower, his condo building on Fifth Avenue, which seemed, again, at a time in the very early 1980s when New York was only recovering from a very, very difficult period of economic downturn, then, you know, there was also excitement about somebody building something fancy that might bring more money into the city. But in fact, it was very kind of cheap and facile and glib and had a lot of glittery elements to it. Wasn't really all that good as a work of architecture. And he used to spread rumors that then Prince Charles was buying an apartment there. And yes, and it was ridiculous. I mean, the British royal family would not buy an apartment anywhere in New York, but particularly not there, I would think. But he got it into the gossip columns, and so
yes,
people would talk about that. And even if people knew it really wasn't true, it got them talking about it. And that was all he cared about, really. He wanted his building talked about. So he would, in fact, a lot of the early buyers of these condos were wealthy Russians, and it later became known that, in fact, a lot of this was a place for them to kind of launder money.
But so now, Paul, Paul, we have your review. Yes. We have a review of yours written at the time,
right,
where you were at least fairly pleased by the atrium of Trump Tower.
I was. No, David, you're absolutely right. I can't deny it, and I won't. You know, it was a time when almost everything was kind of glass and concrete, and he built this atrium in the middle of this with a kind of warm rose-colored marble. And I did find that kind of refreshing. And the idea of public space of this sort was refreshing. Trump, of course, did all he could to milk that. And immediately he started putting up posters in the building with a quote from my review.
Oh, no.
But, of course, took it out of context, only the positive line, and did not quote anything negative that I'd also said. But in fact, you know, Trump Tower was not a terrible building. I think it he certainly did much worse as the years went on. It's not the greatest building. It's not the worst building. And in fact, there was a time early in his career when, because he did seem interested in architecture and he talked a good game, that a lot of people thought that he might, in fact, develop into a more sophisticated, public-spirited developer than indeed he did. Then, in fact, he got very involved in Atlantic City and the movement to build casinos in that depressed part of the seashore. And that was a disaster, not just architecturally, but financially.
But you've got to have glitz for a casino.
That's true.
Fair you've got enough, to feel that enough. You're at the circus.
Well, in a certain way, it was his natural habitat. He was at home there because he liked glitz, and that's a kind of building for which glitz is kind of par for the course. So, of course. And but in fact, you know, they made Trump Tower look like the Parthenon. They were such bad buildings, actually, what he built in Los Angeles. And they did not succeed financially because he overextended himself.
No.
And then he started building less. And actually, it occurred to him, because he was so obsessed with the idea that his name was a synonym for money and luxury and living well and so forth, he actually started licensing his name to other builders and developers, saying that if you call it the Trump this or the Trump that and give me some of the profits and let me run and organize the project for you, then you'll have a more successful building, I'll make some money, and then he didn't have to go through all the hard work of development. So a lot of what he did was in that category, particularly as the years went on. He did a lot of that. I know of a story of one very then younger developer who had not yet been quite successful, but would go on to develop whole sections of Brooklyn and make an enormous amount of money. Trump apparently called him early on and said, you know, this is a new area. People aren't that interested. They'd come if it had my name on it. I'll let you put my name on your building if you just give me 10% of the ownership of it.
Whoa.
Right, right. To which this gentleman said, no, thank you. But
the art of the deal.
The art of the deal. The art of the deal was often just demanding certain things and throwing tantrums if you didn't get them, or claiming that you'd been successful even if you hadn't, which sadly, you know, has an echo in the situation, say, in Iran. I mean, we're not here to talk politics, but we certainly see many of these same patterns of making hasty, not well thought through decisions, and when things turn bad, just declaring that they're not bad, that you've actually won, that people who think otherwise are wrong or don't know anything.
We hadn't thought about this, but I wonder whether bombs can create loopholes. If so, yes, if so, those two aspects of Trump's career. No, no, David, stop it. Stop it. Now, look, Paul, can we turn to you?
Bombs are definitely a form of loophole, yes.
Can we turn to you for an absolute guarantee that his name will not be attached to the ballroom or the triumphal arch?
Well, I think we're pretty sure that, I mean, if he may succeed in getting them built, we still don't know. Because there are lawsuits that several civic organizations, including the National Trust for Historic Preservation, have filed. And so far, while they have not been decisive and final, they seem to be moving through the courts in a way that's been sympathetic to the people who are objecting. We don't know what the final outcome will be. However, I think it's pretty clear that if they are built, they will not be named for him. And the hope of a lot of people is that this process will at least stretch out until a time when he's no longer in the White House. And then a successor can change direction.
And of course, a name can always be chipped off.
Well, as we've seen at the Kennedy Center.
Well, we haven't seen.
Well, right, as we have been told, you're quite right. Thank you for correcting me. As we have been told, has happened at the Kennedy Center, but it's also shrouded in a cover so that nobody can see. Whether that's because the name has never really been taken off or because he does not want people to see what is in many ways a public humiliation of him because he was ordered by a judge to remove it. I truly don't know what the answer is to that.
Looking for a loophole, probably, Paul. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
David, thank you so much for asking me. It's been great talking with you.
And thanks also to Lucy, who is making herself heard once again. Yes. Well, I'm glad to say.
She has very strong feelings about the ballroom.
Does she?
Yes, indeed. Indeed, yes.
She wants one day to lift her leg. No, stop it. Stop it.
Many of us are doing it metaphorically, if not literally. So there we are.
Indeed. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, David. Great talking.
I've been talking to Paul Goldberger, former architecture critic for the New York Times, architecture writer for the New Yorker, and author of a book with an absolutely huge title, Why Architecture Matters, about the taste of Trump.